Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
It would have been so much easier, and we would have been so much lazier if we had just followed that track and produced a book that concluded what everybody else already thought.
Hi all, it is episode 42 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is American author and journalist Jeff Benedict, who you probably know best from his outstanding biography of Tiger Woods that he co-wrote in 2018. Jeff is a special features writer at Sports Illustrated, and he's also written 16 books, along with the Woods book, and his latest is The Dynasty, which is a comprehensive account of the New England Patriots in the era of Robert Kraft, Bill Belichick, and Tom Brady. That book is out now. A reminder, you can get in touch with the show, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the members' WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. Let's get on with the show with Jeff Benedict. Jeff Benedict, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
We'll start with your latest book, The Dynasty, all about the New England Patriots. Can I ask, why now? Why has the book been written at this particular stage?
It's actually a book I've wanted to write for a long time. And I started working on it full-time a couple years ago. So in terms of why now, I feel fortunate. The timing isn't something that I really controlled. It just happened that I finished the book at a time when Tom Brady was leaving the organization. So it worked out from a timing perspective, but I feel like this is a story that in many ways has been waiting to be told, and I'm just glad that I got to do it.
Absolutely. You more or less focused on the three characters of Robert Kraft, Bill Belichick, and Tom Brady. Were you always going to tell the story that way?
I didn't know how I was going to tell the story when I got started. When I was thinking about this project, and I probably thought about this book more than any book I've ever thought about as a writer, I put a lot of time into sort of thinking about the structure of the story, the narrative, where I wanted to go. I didn't figure out until I got in and started really digging into research and doing interviews and observing the team that I wanted to use those three individuals as the main vehicles to tell the story. That became more obvious. You might say it's kind of obvious before you start because of who they are, but it wasn't that obvious to me how I was going to do this until I got in there and started learning what was happening here.
Is it difficult for a writer not to know from the off as to exactly what avenue they're going to go down here, or is it perversely exciting?
I think it's a lot better for the reader to have a writer that doesn't know what he or she is going to do when they go into now I'm talking about nonfiction. With nonfiction books, I think it's much better to not know what you're going to do, because what that implies is you don't have a predetermined outcome. You're not going in with sort of an agenda of, I need to go here and then I got to go there and then do this. Going in wide open is far more, it's not only adventurous, but it's also more objective. And in my case, I just thought there's a huge canvas here, just a really big canvas to paint on. And I can really go in a lot of directions. There's a lot of room to maneuver. So I went in open-minded and objective, thinking I don't really know a lot. I know what's been published and said about this team, and there's certainly been a lot of that. But I like to sort of form my own conclusions about what's been happening.
And can you give us an insight into just the amount of work that went into it in terms of interviews and research?
It makes me tired thinking about that. My methodology in a project like this is I approached it as if I were writing a biography about an individual, except in this case, it was a biography about a franchise or an organization. So a little more complicated than just picking one person and then building a story around them. In this case, it's a big, massive organization and then three characters within it that are all probably worthy of their own biographies. And so I started by constructing a massive timeline. And it took me, I worked on the timeline for a year. And the timeline is over 100 pages long. It's a Word document. And I put everything on that timeline that I thought was important in the 25-year span of the story that I was covering. So that's incredibly time-consuming, because to build that kind of timeline, you have to read a lot. So I read, you know, more than 20 books, and I read thousands of articles that have been published. I watched a lot of film, archival film. All of the reading and watching and listening that I did, I was looking for things to plug into the timeline. The timeline then becomes basically an outline or a framework for a narrative, for a book. And so it's very labor intensive. But once you do that spade work, it gets easier to then see, like, more fully, where are we going? It's like creating a map, basically, and then you can chart your course. And so that's how I started. On the interview front, I was doing interviews while I was building the timeline. And I did hundreds of interviews, obviously spoke to a lot of people. There were some people that I interviewed or spoke to more than others. But, you know, if someone would let me, I would go back to them again and again and again, because I'm trying to get down as deep as I can to drill beneath the surface and get to what I consider the gold.
And what was the gold?
I think the gold is when individuals that you're trying to profile, you develop enough trust and rapport with them that they'll speak with you about things that are more personal. In other words, put your guard down and just speak openly. Making people comfortable enough to speak freely is that it takes time to build that. And one of the most important elements of that is an individual has to trust that you're not going to abuse free conversation. In other words, when someone is just speaking freely and things are just coming out of their mouth, my perspective is I'm not looking for sensational, juicy headline quotes because someone just said something that wasn't carefully thought out. And that's, I think, what's really important is the person has to know you're not going to do that to them, because that's not the goal here. The goal is you're trying to get knowledge, trying to get information out of them that enables you to tell a great story. So you want people to talk freely enough that, frankly, they might use four-letter words loosely when they're talking to you. And they need to know that when you quote them, you're not going to sprinkle all these four-letter words into the quote, because you know what I mean? It's like, it's those kinds of things. So it's being judicious about how you do that. And I think a lot of times, for instance, I'd be interviewing someone and they'd use the F word in a response. And it's sort of a gratuitous use of the F word. And then they catch themselves and say, oh, please don't use that in my quote. And I would say, don't worry about it. I would never have intended to do that anyways, because it's not needed in the quote. You know what I'm saying? Mm. It's different. It's different than if you have someone who's recreating dialogue and they're recounting an intense conversation they had 2 years ago, and in the dialogue they use the F word. Well, that I would use in the book, because you're recreating a conversation that actually happened. But if I'm just interviewing like we're doing right now and I let an F word slip out of my mouth, that's not something I would use in the quote, because it's different. And so that's just a little example, but I think when you get to that point with an interviewer and an interviewee where they realize that you're just going to be mindful of them and that you're looking out for them, because you're not looking for the slip up. You're looking for knowledge and information that enables you to tell a good story.
You definitely told a great story. And obviously it was focused about the three men, Kraft, Belichick and Brady, and the relationships between them are entirely fascinating. And I think, well, I certainly found that the most interesting one is that between Belichick and Brady, or Brady and Belichick, maybe, to see it from Brady's perspective. You write a couple of times in the book that Brady strove for fatherly approval from Belichick. Did he get it, do you think?
You know, I think he probably never got it to the degree that he wanted it. Tom is a very loyal person to begin with. And he is extremely disciplined and hardworking. And I think where he got that kind of fatherly approval is he got it from his father, Tom Brady Sr., and he got it from Robert Kraft, the owner or his employer. And both of them were really good at doing that. And the reason it's worth saying that is because a lot of fathers are not really good at showing their children fatherly approval. I think Tom Brady's father was exceptional at that. And many sports owners, sports team owners, are not good at all at showing that kind of approval and building the kind of relationship with Brady that Robert Kraft built. So from two places, he got that. From his head coach, it really comes down to the kind of coach and personality that Bill Belichick has. And so he didn't communicate or physically demonstrate that kind of relationship the way, for example, Robert Kraft did. They had a different way of doing that. I think Belichick's way of showing how much he valued and appreciated Brady was how much trust he put in his hands. Now, that's an unspoken communication of approval. It doesn't involve saying anything. It doesn't involve a physical pat on the back. But clearly, he looked at Brady as someone he absolutely trusted with putting the controls of the offense in his hands and letting him go. He did that for 20 years. He started when he was an unproven rookie. And so I think that was his way. It's a harder edge. And I think that's what builds that interesting part of that interesting complexity between the two men.
Relations did sour pretty badly between them, if that's correct.
I mean, I would say it differently. What I would say is that this is a relationship that had real tension in it at times, particularly in the last 10 years. You got to look at it in its totality, though, and put the right context around it. These are two guys that when they met each other, they were really – Bill Belichick was an unproven head coach. He wasn't a winner at that point. He had a losing record. And Tom Brady had never started a game when Belichick put him in the starting lineup. So in a way, Belichick staked his career on an unproven rookie. And Brady hitched his wagon to an unproven coach. And so if you look at the early years of the relationship, it's a fantastic formative partnership between two guys who very quickly get to the top of the mountain together. I mean, they win a Super Bowl together in their first year that Brady's on the field. And then they win two more in the next 3 years. So three Super Bowls in 4 years it's pretty incredible. So that's the foundation of the relationship. And I think as time goes on, if their relationship had gone the way every previous head coach quarterback relationship had gone in the annals of the NFL, after about 10 years, they would have broken up and parted ways. That didn't happen here, and that's because of Robert Kraft. That's another story. But the point is they stayed together for a second 10-year period, meaning 20 years. And in the second 10 years, they won three more Super Bowls and went to five more. So I think you should expect a lot of tension in a relationship like that. Let's face it. I make the comparison of Paul McCartney and John Lennon in this book for a reason. When you become the best rock band in the world and you are the best songwriters in the world, there's going to be tension. And that tension produced some incredible music for the whole world. And I think similarly with Brady and Belichick, they were a winning machine. The Beatles were a hit machine. The Patriots were a winning machine. There was tension in the relationship. But the bottom line is, when Bill Belichick put on a headset and Tom Brady put on a helmet, they went places that no one else could go. And I think the miracle here is that they were able to do it for 20 years. So that to me is the story. That's really what it's about. That's a lot more interesting than the idea that there was a little tension along the way. There should be.
Yeah. And now we have another really possibly amazing story in which both have gone their separate ways ahead of next season. I mean, can either of them function without the other?
Oh, I think they can.
Sorry, function is a bad word. Be successful.
You know, time will tell. But I think these are two... I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that in the last 20 years of American football, there's been nobody more competitive and more determined to win year in and year out than those two guys. So whether they're, when they're together, as they have been for two decades, I describe it as an unfair advantage. You've got the two best guys on the same payroll for 20 years. It's unfair if you're one of the other teams. Now they're not on the same payroll, but it's not like their drive to win is in any way diminished. So I suspect that both of these guys, as long as they're doing their jobs, will be successful.
Obviously, the book is exceptionally deeply reported and exhaustive, so it's littered with gems. Now, just to pick out one small one is the fact that Bon Jovi had a bit of a role in Belichick getting the Patriots job.
Yeah, one of the reasons I was so excited about writing this book is because I saw an opportunity to write about Bono and the Edge and Elton John and Bon Jovi and some of these world-class musicians and actors and people that you wouldn't expect in a book about a football team. But in this case, it's all fitting because in Bon Jovi's case, Bon Jovi had a history with Bill Belichick that preceded his arrival in New England. They were friends from when Bill Belichick used to coach the New York Giants. So he becomes a Patriots fan when Belichick goes to New England, and he's hanging around the team. At that time, Belichick was the assistant coach for the Patriots, and Robert Kraft is looking for a new coach, and he's got his eye on Belichick, but he doesn't know if he wants to offer him the job. And so at the Super Bowl, Bon Jovi's there and he's on the field, and Kraft knows that he's friendly with Belichick. So he walks up to him during the practice and he says, you know, tell me about your friend. And Bon Jovi goes, you mean Belichick? And he's like, yeah. And so it's the beginning of this really interesting dynamic. So Bon Jovi's smart. He's savvy. He realizes what this is. This is basically the owner of the team asking him for a referral, for a job recommendation. Do you think this guy would be a good fit here? And you think, why would the owner of a team be asking a rock and roll star about that? But the reason he's doing that is because Kraft is so interesting. He already knows Belichick's a great coach. He's trying to find out what's he like as a person. That's what he doesn't know about. And he knows Bon Jovi can tell him because Bon Jovi's close to him. And so Bon Jovi does. He, right on the football field, he tells him personal anecdotes about Bill. And so Bon Jovi actually stays in my narrative because he then becomes sort of a fixture in New England. It's really great.
Yeah, well, the book is terrific, and there's way more to it than we can do justice here. So I do highly recommend it, and it is out now for listeners listening into this from when this podcast goes out. To talk about yourself for a few moments, Jeff, if you're not too bashful, your route into writing was atypical, if I can use that phrase.
My route into writing was atypical, yes. Never went to journalism school. Never took a class in how to write, never took a writing course. Other than in law school, I was required to take legal writing, but legal writing is very different than what I do now. But yeah, it was a different course. I studied history in college, and then I went to graduate school and got a degree, an advanced degree in politics, and then I went to law school, and I was never intending to become a writer. But I started writing just on my own when I was heading into law school. Not because I was going to do it for a profession or because I thought I'd make money from it. I wasn't thinking about any of that. I just had things in my mind that were important to me that I wanted to write about. And so I was doing that. And mostly I was writing about violence against women because it was something I studied a lot in graduate school and in law school. And I was actually thinking as a lawyer that I would work in that area of the law when I came out of law school. So that's kind of where my head was. But when I started writing about it, it was right around the time that O.J. Simpson had been charged with murder in the United States for killing his wife. And Mike Tyson, the boxer, had been arrested for assaulting a woman in the United States. And so the things I was writing got a lot of attention, which I didn't anticipate. And it led to opportunities to write professionally. And so it was a purely organic experience for me, and it forced me to make a decision between whether to become a lawyer or whether to go a completely different route and go into journalism. And I chose the journalism route because, first of all, I loved writing, and it was something that I loved as soon as I started doing it. It was a great form of communication. And more importantly, I loved the ability to reach a larger audience than I would if I were a prosecutor, which was what I thought I was going to be when I entered law school. And prosecutors talk to audiences of 12 in America, 12 jurors sit on a jury. And I thought about how a book can reach hundreds of thousands of people, or maybe even millions. And so it wasn't a hard decision once the opportunity arose.
Is it difficult? Did you find it a difficult subject matter to write about? Like the intersection
of violence against women?
Yeah, and where it intersected with sport, because you have written about it a few times. And it also actually, you know, stokes the Patriots book as well, just in the background in terms of what has been happening in the NFL with Ray Rice and other characters.
Yeah, so look, it's an issue that has always mattered a lot to me as a husband, as a father, as a man. And so I started my career in journalism writing about that issue. I never wanted to be pigeonholed as a single issue writer because I write nonfiction. And, you know, I could have just done every book and article about that issue. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to go broader. So I've written about a lot of other things over the years. But when it's appropriate, and I thought in this New England Patriots book, it certainly was, that the whole issue of violence against women, or just how men view women, had a place in the New England Patriots story, and it has a place in more than one occasion. One of the reasons it has such a prominent place is because Robert Kraft's wife, Myra Kraft, this was something that was incredibly important to her. She had invested a lot of money and a lot of time in nonprofit organizations that were built to counter violence against women in the greater Boston area. It was an issue that mattered to her. And so it became, the Patriots, I think, were an organization that were much more sensitive to the issue than anyone else in the league was. At a time when the NFL wasn't even focused on violence against women, the Patriots did some things that were completely uncharacteristic for other NFL teams. And to me, that was important, partly because I happened to have written about those things 25 years earlier when they happened. And now it was a chance to put those incidents in the larger context of the Patriots organization. And then to finally take it to the last step, by the time the Ray Rice thing happens, the Patriots are a winning monopoly at that point. And Robert Kraft is clearly the most influential and accomplished owner in the NFL. And so although the Ray Rice incident technically had nothing to do with the New England Patriots, because he's not a Patriots player, Kraft is involved in that issue because in a certain sense he's advising and guiding the commissioner Roger Goodell, who really was involved in that issue and had to deal with it, and it was very controversial. And I think seeing how Robert Kraft navigated that is important for the reader to see.
Another figure who crops up a few times in the Patriots book is Donald Trump, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you've had a run-in with Trump in the past.
I mean, I probably, this goes back, I'm dating myself, 20 years. There is one time in my career where I took a very brief hiatus from writing, and I ran a nonprofit organization in Connecticut, the state where I live in the United States, because we were being overrun with Las Vegas-style casinos. And Donald Trump was one of the people who was trying to do that in Connecticut. So my nonprofit partnered with the legislature in Connecticut and with other advocacy groups to try to stop any more casinos from coming in. And that brought me to Congress, where I testified under oath in front of a number of hearings about his petition to try to bring a casino to Connecticut. So yes.
Is there a winning in this? Like, is a fair question to ask? Did you win?
Fortunately, we did. He never got to build one there, and that was a good thing for our state.
From a European sport point of view, like, European sport has been totally taken over by gambling companies in terms of they sponsor the teams, they name the stadium, they advertise during all the TV ads. And up until a couple of years ago, you know, it hadn't been allowed in American sport, but that's changing now. You know, the drawbridge is down, and the gambling companies are rushing in. I wonder, do you have an opinion on that?
I don't have an opinion on it because I don't know enough about it. It's not something I've studied, and I'm never comfortable talking about things that I'm not well versed in. So I'm going to pass on that one.
Yeah, no problem at all. Let's skip on to something you are very well versed on, is Tiger Woods, because I think that is where certainly I first became aware of your work, Jeff, and a lot of our listeners did as well. You wrote it like an outstanding and exhaustive biography on Woods with Armen Ketian. It must be difficult to write the definitive story of a man who's called his private yacht Privacy.
Yeah, I think, well, that's what makes it more compelling and interesting. I've always been drawn to people who are more introverted because I think there's so much more going on there that is not visible to the eye. And Tiger certainly it has been and is an introvert. And I say that in a complimentary way. Some of the people that I admire the most in my life are introverts. I think he's in a career that almost forces you in some respects to be introverted if you want to maintain some sanity. And so Armen and I were drawn to that. We thought that there was a lot of ground here that could be penetrated and cultivated as biographers. And so I was excited about it. And true to form, sure enough, there was a lot about his personality and his past that I think had been unexamined, and we were able to examine it and bring it to light. And I think in a really good way, it actually provided a perspective of him that was new and different, and in my opinion, much more rounded. So like for someone like me, I think my respect for him kept going up. The deeper we dug, the more my respect for him increased. So it wasn't the other way around. You'd think if you dig into someone's personal life, you're going to start seeing things that you're like, ugh, I wish I didn't know that. In his case, all of that stuff was already out there. What wasn't out there was the explanatory information around him. And so when you start to excavate that, your respect level, and I'm speaking personally, my respect level and my admiration for him just kept going up and up.
An explanatory material in what sense? His relationship with his father, I suppose, most.
His relationship with his parents, the way he was raised, his dedication to excellence, what it takes to... I mean, the central question that we were examining in that book was, what does it take to become the greatest in the world at one thing? Because there's only one person who can do that on the planet. There's only one Shakespeare, right? I mean, there's only one Beatles. There's only one Einstein. There's only one Tiger Woods. And so nobody really can say, well, I know what it's like to walk in his shoes, because you don't. And so I think when you start to get some context around that and realize what it has cost him, what he's had to do to become what he is, what you and I like to watch when he performs, the satisfaction that he's brought to so many millions of golf fans, when you understand the cost, how can you not respect and admire what he's done to get there? I mean, I think he is, after all, a human being, right? It's so easy to lose sight of the fact that he's a man. He's a husband, a father, a son. He's all those things. We lose sight of that when we always just think of him as this iconic golfer. And so we were trying to personalize him in a way that I think, at least our goal was to enable people to understand and appreciate him more, not just as a great golfer, but as a man.
He became the best in the world. From your point of view, was it worth it?
Well, only he can answer that. That's not really something that I think a biographer should be weighing in on, because that's a judgment call. And I would never make that judgment call. You know, someone could say the same thing about me. Not that I'm the greatest writer in the world, but just that you spend all this time on writing one book. When you do that, that's less time for your family. That's less time for service, all these other things. Is it worth it? And only I can really answer that, you know?
Hmm. Okay. Is it worth it from your point of view?
I mean, in my case, I would say that it is. At least at this point in my life, I feel like that, because in my case, working hard at a craft and becoming good at something, at one thing, and trying to become good enough at it that people will actually want to read what you write, make an investment in you and make a purchase and feel engrossed in your writing. That process for me has been really enriching for my family. In other words, if it only benefited me, then I would answer that question, no. But in my case, it's actually been a great career for raising children. In other words, my kids have had a lot of involvement in my profession. Maybe if I was a lawyer, like I originally wanted to be, that wouldn't be the case. Mm. And if I had become a really good lawyer, I'm not sure that's a profession that's really suitable for including your family. But being a writer, I have found ways to integrate my family into my job in real positive ways. They've met so many interesting people that I've written about. My family has got to not just meet them, but engage and now count many of them as friends, lifetime friends. And so it's enriched our family in a way that I would say, yes, it's been worth it.
Have they, or indeed you, met Tiger since the book came out?
No.
Have you tried?
No. I mean, in Tiger's case, it was an unauthorized biography, and I think it would be a little presumptuous to try to arrange a meeting. Obviously, if he ever wanted to meet or talk to me, I would do it in a heartbeat. But I also understand why he wouldn't want to do that necessarily. It's a different dynamic than the biography I wrote before that was Steve Young. And I spent 5 years with Steve. And the relationship I have with Steve today is like a brother. You know, but it's different because that biography was him asking me to write his biography for him. And so naturally there was a kind of affection, fortunately, that developed over the course of time working on the project. And so it really depends on the kind of project it is.
Do you ever wonder if Woods read the book?
I don't know. I don't think about that. I really don't. I just, what I think about is just how many people said to me in private that the book changed their opinion of him. And I never had a person say it changed their opinion in a negative way. Every single person that confided in me, and these include people who know him or have had dealings with him. Every one of those individuals who's confided in me said, the book changed my opinion of him. I like him more. And so that's actually what matters to me more than anything. Not that was my goal. I didn't set out to do that. Neither did Armin. But I think in terms of biographers, I would have been disappointed to have written a biography about a figure like him and have people say to me after, that book really made me dislike him even more. I would have feel like we failed at our job.
Really? Okay. Because like there's the journalistic idea of being, you know, totally objective and you make up your own mind. But that's an interesting, that's a very different take, I guess.
Well, I think it's actually more objective because so many people had already made up their mind and it was a negative mindset. And so, in other words, it would have been so much easier and we would have been so much lazier if we had just followed that track and produced a book that concluded what everybody else already thought. Okay. Like, that would be easy to do. That's just like a pig pile. We just need to get on top of it. We're trying to do something that is a lot more work and takes a lot more time because it requires you to really understand contextually who is he. That's that spade work where we're doing hundreds and hundreds of interviews with all these different people from every facet of his life going back to his childhood. That's an effort. To me, that is journalism. That's really hard work. Now, obviously, if we had done all that and the conclusion was the same, well, then that's what we would have wrote. But I think what we found in going through that is time and time again, we interviewed people who, whether it was his first girlfriend or his third one or whatever, they had affection for him. They had sorrow. They knew him when he was still, shall we say, innocent. And I think that's the part, the humanization of him, that really appealed to people. Like, and that's what was all new. So for us, we felt like we're just plowing headlong into new territory.
Yeah. This is my final Tiger question, I promise. But I understand you're involved in a HBO documentary movie about Tiger later this year. I don't know if you can spill the beans on anything that's involved.
All I can say is, yes, I was one of the producers on the film, and it will be on HBO in December. Those dates have been published, and the film has been announced, so I'm not making any news here, but and I'm excited about it. I mean, I think it's a, you know, in some ways, for Armin and I, it's you want to write, look, at this point in time, you want to write books that have a life beyond the book, that you've found a topic that's not only important enough, but it's entertaining enough, and it matters to enough people that a movie could be made about it, that a documentary film could be produced, that a theatrical production could come. And so with each book that I choose these days, I always want to find a topic like the New England Patriots. It's a massive topic. It's big in every way. And so the potential for that to become other things, for the book to be a springboard to films and other things, is there. I look for that whenever I'm selecting a book topic. I hope that as a storyteller, you can tell your story on other platforms and mediums.
That brings us beautifully onto the three books that you submitted to chat to us about today, because two of them have made it to the big screen, Buzz Bissinger's Friday Night Lights and Laura Hildenbrand's Seabiscuit. Let's maybe start with Friday Night Lights, and why did you nominate that book?
Well, I picked Friday Night Lights because I remember when I wrote that book, when I read that book, that's when I was in my graduate school, law school days, and I was, finding my bearings in life, reading a lot of things, not reading sports books, by the way, but reading serious historical biographies and political books. I didn't read much fiction then. I wrote a lot of serious nonfiction, reading books about the Vietnam War and, you know, things like that. And then I read Friday Night Lights, and it really took hold of me. It was just so well done, and it was so unexpected that a book about high school football in Texas could actually be that captivating. And so I love the fact that the book then had another life and became a television show and all that. But that, for me, was the first sports book that actually impacted me in a more serious way versus reading about some great athlete's biography where he's basically recounting all his wins.
And why did it affect you more than the athlete who talks about his wins?
Because it was about something that mattered. You know, this was, it was about real people. It was about, there were times when it made me sad, you know, and there were times when it made me question the whole business of high school football. When you read a book that starts making you question the way you think about things, I think the writer's done a really good job. And that book made me do that. It made me watch football differently.
And Seabiscuit, which I shamefully have never read, I have to say. So why did you nominate that?
I just thought Seabiscuit was, I mean, look, just from a pure writing experience, or pure reading experience, the writing was so phenomenal, it was so fluid. You felt like you could see the horse breathing in your face. I don't follow horse racing. Like, I don't even care about horse racing. I was so wrapped up in Seabiscuit, couldn't put it down. You know, read it like a train ride, just, you know, turning pages, and then absolutely loved the movie. I thought the movie did great justice to the book.
And the third and final of your picks, Jeff, was Andre Agassi's Open.
So Agassi's book Open, I've read a lot of sports biographies over the year. I've never read one like his. That is my favorite in terms of sports biographies and autobiographies. That's my favorite. The honesty was just overpowering. The conversational nature of his delivery in the book. I just love the way Andre basically, you know, pulled his shirt back and let you look in his soul. And I love a guy who's on top of the world who will show you his blemishes the way he did. Just enough, you know, it's not over the top, but he's showing you enough to say, hey, I'm not perfect, and I realize that, but this is who I am. And so I actually read that book multiple times. I read it twice before I wrote Steve Young's autobiography because I wanted to actually make sure. I told Steve, I said, this is our bar. You know, we're looking at Agassi and I want to write a book that gets as close to that as we can. I reread it before Armin and I wrote Tiger Woods. And then I looked at it again before I did the Patriots book.
What you say there about Agassi, the fact that he was open, pun intended, and allowed people, the entire world to see his blemishes. And what you did for Tiger in terms of contextualizing his whole life, doesn't it show that like these celebrity sports stars are benefit from being open to the media and being open to the world at a time when, you know, when advances in technology and so on allows them to kind of close off from the media and just put their own vision of themselves out there?
Well, I would say that I think I understand why any celebrity, we're talking about athletes right now, but celebrated athletes, the quest for privacy and controlling their own narrative makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, they have wives, they have kids, and they have TMZ looking at them. They have all of these sports networks. There's just not much in the way of privacy. It's hard to protect anything. And so I get it. I not only get it, if you could get in their shoes, I think I would do the same thing. And so I understand that. And I also can appreciate why someone who has the ability would want to do what they could to sort of control their narrative. I mean, anybody would want to do that. Like if you knew someone was going to write all about you and you had the chance to sort of write it first, you'd probably take it. If enough people cared like to hear my biography, which they don't, but if they did, I'd think I'd probably want to write my autobiography first and get my story out there. You know what I'm saying? And I think that that's kind of where that comes from. So I'm not critical of that at all. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, Jeff, we're pressed for time. We have three stock questions that we throw on the spot to all of our guests, I'm afraid. And I apologize in advance. They do get worse as they go along. I'm going to start by asking, who is the most interesting person you've ever met with work?
I don't even think I can answer that. I don't, because I've met too many very fascinating people. And if I singled one out, it wouldn't be right. So I can't answer that. It's not.
Give us a few names out of the Rolodex.
So if I did it chronologically, I could do it that way and say the first one I would come up with was the scientist from the Natural History Museum at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., who studies skeletal remains. He studies 10,000-year-old skeletons. And I spent 3 years with him and thought he's the most fascinating human I've ever come across in my life, partly because of what he does. But that was pretty early in my career. And so from there, I started meeting, more and more people like that who are just different. I met a guy named Bill Marler, who is the number one food safety lawyer in the world. All he does is work on cases of food poisoning that kill and maim people. And he's the best at it on the planet. And I was drawn to him because he's the best at it in the world. And when I spent a few years with him, I thought, he's one of the most fascinating, compelling people I've ever met. I had a chance to interview Warren Buffett, the great investor at Berkshire Hathaway. You know what I mean? You can start going down the line and say, how do you distinguish between one and the other?
Okay, where is the most interesting place you've been with work?
Jerusalem.
Okay. Where you went with the Patriots, if I'm right.
Yeah, the Holy Land. I would say that. Now, again, I'm not having time to think about that. And if I sat around for an hour and thought about it, but off the top of my head, I would say the Holy Land because it was such a transformative experience for me. And also because it brought into focus so many things that I knew only in my mind from reading the Bible or reading history books or to go there and actually see where Jesus walked and to look at such an ancient city, to go to the Sea of Galilee, to basically be in these places, it definitely changed my life. And so I would just answer the Holy Land.
And our final question is the worst of them all, I'm afraid. If you had written only one of the three books that you submitted to us. So that's Andre Agassi's Open, Laura Hillenbrand's Seabiscuit, or Buzz Bissinger's The Friday Night Lights. Which one of those would you have written and why?
You mean which one do I wish I could write that well?
Yeah.
I would say probably Seabiscuit, just because I think every writer, every nonfiction writer looks at that and says, at least I do, I look at that and go, wow, that's exceptional. And so when you're aiming for something, you know, I would aim for that. Now, I typically don't write those kinds of books. I write books that are more like Open. And so, you know, the skill of a biographer who worked with Andre, I obviously admire that greatly.
Mm. Jeff, thank you so much for doing the show with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was great.
Yes, thank you very much to Jeff, and thanks as ever to you for listening in and supporting the show and the 42 as a whole. We are going to be back next week with another great guest, but until then, take it easy.